Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners. So we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Alice Bryant. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, at the San Diego Zoo in Southern California, little Kurt looks and acts like any other baby horse. He likes to play, pushes against anything that gets in his way, and runs to his mother for milk when he is hungry. But the 2-month-old differs from every other baby horse in the world in a major way. Kurt is a clone. He was created in a laboratory. Scientists used cells taken from a male Kowalski's horse in 1980. The cells had been frozen for the last 40 years. The scientists also took an egg from a female horse of a different breed. Then they removed the egg's nucleus and replaced it with the cells from the Kowalski's horse. The resulting embryo was placed in the womb of another female horse for development. She gave birth to Kurt on August 6th. Scientists have cloned more than 20 other kinds of animals, including dogs, cats, pigs, cows, and mice. In 2018, researchers in China created monkeys for the first time using the same cloning methods that produced the first cloned animal, Dolly the sheep, in 1996. San Diego Zoo officials say Kurt is the first cloned Kowalski's horse, a rare and endangered breed. The zoo sees Kurt's birth as a major step in efforts to reestablish the population of the Kowalski's horse, also known as the Asiatic wild horse or Mongolian wild horse. The small, thick-set horses are believed to have disappeared from the wild. About 2,000 live in zoos and wildlife centers. Bob Weiss is Chief Life Sciences Officer at San Diego Zoo Global, which operates the zoo. He said that Kurt is expected to be one of the most genetically important individuals of his breed. "We are hopeful that he will bring back genetic variation important for the future of the Kowalski's horse population," he added. Kurt was named for Dr. Kurt Benerschka, who created the Frozen Zoo, a research and collection center at the San Diego Zoo. It provided the scientists with the Kowalski's horse cells used to make Kurt. The zoo worked jointly with the California Conservation Group Revive and Restore and the Texas-based company Viagen Equine in creating Kurt. He was born at a veterinary facility in Texas. He is expected to continue to live there with his mother for another year. Later, Kurt will move to the San Diego Zoo to live with other Kowalski's horses. Zoo officials hope Kurt will someday become a father himself. Kowalski's horses take their official name from Russian explorer Nikolai Kowalski, who found a skull and skin of one and shared it with a Russian museum. At one time, the horses lived throughout Europe and Asia, says the Smithsonian's National Zoo and Biology Conservation Institute. Growing populations of humans and farm animals pushed them out of Europe and east into Asia. Outside of zoos, they exist today only in special protected areas of Mongolia, China, and Kazakhstan. The Smithsonian says Przewalski's horses are the only true wild horses left in the world. It says that wild horse groups in North America and Australia are not truly wild because their ancestors were horses that escaped human owners.
Returning to school in Washington, D.C. during the coronavirus crisis has been an experiment in learning. Charter schools are trying out in-person schooling for small groups. A charter school is a tax-supported school created through a legal agreement between a school board and an outside group. Meridian Charter School, for example, experimented with ways to prevent the spread of the new coronavirus. The school set up tall, three-sided dividers to keep students separated. But then school officials learned that this would not really prevent the spread of the virus. Now the dividers are not required, but more than half of the students still use them as personal organizers, putting notes and pictures on them. It's all a learning experience, and it's all playing out in real time, said Matt McCray, Meridian's head of school. Most of Washington's 52,000 public school children are dealing with learning on computers in virtual classrooms. But more than 10 charter schools have experimented by giving in-person classes to small groups of students. The charter schools are smaller and sometimes have better resources than the D.C. Public Schools System, or DCPS. So they have been able to make these changes quickly. This is our attempt to redesign school, said Myron Long. He is executive director of the Social Justice School. It is offering in-person classes to about 15 of its 50 total students. It is a process that Washington, D.C. Public Schools has watched as the organization plans its own return to the classroom. Mayor Muriel Bowser had planned to start the 2020 to 2021 school year with a combined model. The idea was to have virtual learning with 2 days each week of in-school teaching. However, the city had to change that plan because of safety concerns raised by the teachers' union. The city studied the charter experiments to see what's working, Bowser said. But, she noted, DCPS will have to make decisions that affect 60 buildings, 50,000 students, and over 4,000 employees. The most recent reopening plan for Washington, D.C.'s public schools seems to take ideas from the charter school's experiences. Parents are given choices for how they want their child to attend. For example, one choice would give in-person classes to a small group of students. Students with special education needs, students learning English, and students who are homeless or otherwise at risk would be included in this group. Those are mainly the kinds of learners DC charter schools chose for their own student groups for in-person classes. We wanted the spots to go to students and families that had the greatest need, said Justin Lessick. He is executive director of the Sojourner Truth Charter School, which is giving in-person classes to 20 of its 93 students. In some cases, spots or placements were given to the children of essential workers. Meridian Charter School had to deny some parents. But the Social Justice School was able to take every student whose parent showed interest. Some parents contacted us and just said, "We have nowhere for them to go during the day," Long said. Each charter school develops its own health safety rules. At Meridian, all students and visitors have their temperature taken upon arrival. Social Justice School does more. There, visiting reporters were required to wear full medical clothing, including hand and face coverings, just to enter the building. "There is a huge amount of trial and error," said Shannon Hodge. She is with the DC Charter School Alliance, a nonprofit group that advocates for the charter system. At the Social Justice School, each of the three student groups is given a bathroom to use. At both Meridian and Social Justice, water fountains are not in use. Students at Meridian have their own water containers and can fill them at special water devices. The Social Justice School opened its doors for the first time this fall after approval from the DC Public Charter School Board. So it has never operated under normal conditions. The school places importance on the values of social and racial awareness. It seeks to build a strong community around its 50 students and families. But it has been nearly impossible for this new community to meet over the summer. Now, school officials have started holding outdoor gatherings around the city on Wednesdays. During those hours, there are no classes, so students, parents, teachers, and other workers can safely meet each other. The school has also launched a new kind of in-person teaching. Students attending class in person are joined by students attending online through video. Everyone in the in-person classroom is on a computer. The teachers in the classroom teach all of the students together. Long said the idea came about partly because the small school did not have enough teachers to teach in physical and virtual classrooms. But the communal plan also fits the school's values of equality, he said. Mayor Bowser's education officials have been in contact with charter schools to learn from all of the activities. I'm Alice Bryant.
Are you at risk of getting seriously ill from the new coronavirus? Here are some things to keep in mind. 80% of coronavirus cases are mild. Young and healthy people are at low risk. Other people and those with serious health conditions have a greater risk of serious illness or even death. If you have a cough, fever, and difficulty breathing, contact the doctor and stay away from other people. For more information, visit the World Health Organization website at www.who.int or the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention at www.cdc.gov.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. Early in 1857, the United States Supreme Court announced one of its most important rulings. The High Court decided the case of a slave named Dred Scott. Harry Monroe and Leo Scully tell us about the ruling and the continuing national debate over slavery.
Dred Scott lived in Missouri, where slavery was legal. Then he was sold to a man who took him to Illinois and Wisconsin, where slavery was not legal. After 4 years, he was returned to Missouri. Dred Scott demanded his freedom because of the years he had spent in places where slavery was illegal. Congress had banned slavery in those places under the Missouri Compromise Act of 1820. The Supreme Court ruled that Congress did not have the power to close territories to slavery. It said the Missouri Compromise was a violation of the United States Constitution, and that Dred Scott was not a free man.
James Buchanan was sworn in as president at the time of the Dred Scott case. Buchanan believed the Supreme Court's decision would put an end to the dispute over slavery. He believed that Americans, North and South, would accept the decision as the final word in the dispute. This did not happen. The Dred Scott decision did not calm the storm that divided the nation. Instead, it increased its fury.
New trouble threatened to break out in the territory of Kansas between pro-slavery and anti-slavery settlers. In the past few years, the two sides had argued and fought over their opinions. They even had formed two separate governments. The pro-slavery forces controlled the legal government. The anti-slavery forces controlled an opposition government which had no power. Supporters of slavery wanted to organize a constitutional convention that could put Kansas into the Union as a slave state. The pro-slavery legislature passed a bill calling for such a convention. The bill gave supporters of slavery every chance to control the election of delegates to the convention. And it gave the convention complete freedom to make its own rules. The bill provided no way for the people of Kansas to vote on their own constitution.
The governor of the Kansas Territory, John Geary, vetoed the bill. But the legislature quickly overruled his veto. Pro-slavery men called for Geary to get out of Kansas. Some talked of shooting him if he did not leave. Governor Geary had been living under extreme tension for months. He had worked hard to keep Kansas peaceful. He was angry because he could get no help from the federal government. He sent his resignation to President Buchanan. Then the former governor spoke publicly. He said most of the settlers in Kansas were peace-loving people. He said only a small group was responsible for the trouble there. Geary said a few powerful men hoped to make Kansas a slave state. If this failed, Geary said, they hoped their actions would produce civil war.
President Buchanan appointed a new governor for Kansas. Buchanan told him that slavery in the territory must be decided on the votes of the people of the territory. And he said the people must be given a fair chance to approve or reject a constitution for statehood. The new governor arrived in Kansas at the end of May 1857. He explained his policies in a speech to the people of Kansas. The new governor promised to enforce the laws of the pro-slavery legislature, but only those laws which were constitutional. He urged everyone to vote in the coming election of delegates to the Constitutional Convention. He said he was hopeful that the convention would offer its constitution to the people for their approval or rejection. He added that Congress would not accept Kansas as a slave state or a free state until the people had voted on the question of slavery.
On June 15th, the election was held for delegates to the Constitutional Convention. Most anti-slavery men did not vote because their names had been kept off the voting lists by pro-slavery officials. Others refused to vote because they believed the election was unfair. 60 delegates were elected. All supported slavery. They planned to meet in the autumn to begin work on a constitution for Kansas. Most of the delegates were wild, rough men who found it difficult to read and write. But these men were sure of one thing. They wanted Kansas to be a slave state.
The delegates began the Constitution by claiming that the right of property was higher than any constitutional power. They said a slave owner had as much right to his property as the owner of any other kind of property. Then they wrote the different parts of the document. One part of the Constitution severely limited the right of the legislature to free slaves. Another part barred free Negroes from entering Kansas. And another prevented the Constitution from being changed for 7 years.
Most of the delegates to the Kansas Constitutional Convention wanted to send the document directly to Congress for approval. They did not want to give the people of Kansas a chance to vote on it. They were sure that the majority of the population would reject a constitution that made slavery legal. Some delegates, however, knew that Congress would not approve statehood for Kansas unless the people voted on the Constitution. The two sides finally agreed on a compromise.
The Constitution itself would not be offered to the people. Instead, the people would vote only on the question of slavery. They could vote for the Constitution with slavery or the Constitution without slavery. If the voters approved the Constitution with slavery, then Kansas would be open to new slaves. If they approved the Constitution without slavery, then Kansas would be closed to new slaves. Slaves already in the territory could be kept there. This compromise brought a cry of anger from opponents of slavery in Kansas. They said the Constitutional Convention had only given them the right to vote for limited slavery or unlimited slavery. It had not given them the right to vote for freedom.
President Buchanan had promised the people of Kansas that they would have a fair chance to vote on their Constitution. But members of his cabinet told him to forget this promise. They said Americans were tired of the dispute in Kansas and would accept any settlement. They told Buchanan that approval of the Constitution would end the Kansas problem. It would satisfy the South, they said, and the North would soon forget about Kansas. Under this pressure, President Buchanan made his decision. He would ask Congress to accept the pro-slavery Kansas Constitution and make the territory a slave state.
In Kansas, the vote on slavery was held. Most opponents of slavery did not vote. They were waiting until they could vote against the complete statehood constitution. Many of the votes were illegal. Still, Kansas officials declared that slavery had been approved. They urged Congress to make Kansas a state under this condition. Shortly after, President Buchanan sent Congress a similar message. Buchanan's chief opponent on the statehood bill was a member of his own Democratic Party, Senator Stephen Douglas of Illinois. Douglas did not oppose slavery, but he believed that the people of a territory had the right to make their own decision to accept or reject slavery.
Stephen Douglas united other Democrats and members of the anti-slavery Republican Party to fight against the bill in the Senate. He lost. The Senate approved the bill to make Kansas a state where slavery was legal. The House of Representatives, however, rejected the bill. Instead, it approved a bill to let the people of Kansas vote again on their statehood constitution. The Senate approved a compromise version of this House bill.
So the people of Kansas got another chance to show that they did not want a pro-slavery constitution. They voted and rejected the constitution by a large majority. The pro-slavery statehood constitution was dead. Kansas would continue as a territory for a few more years, but there would be no further attempt to make it a slave state.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.